representative of corporate greed job he's doing. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, March 5th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Anna Wilcox, Dan Raphael, and myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Judith Ruiz Branch, Suzanne Potter. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Sherry Meredith. All of our KABU programs, including Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kabu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KABU News in Depth. We're talking immigrant justice and the Sanctuary Promise Act with Cedra Pearson from the Rural Organizing Project.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Cedra Pearson from the Rural Organizing Project to talk about immigration justice and Oregon's Sanctuary Promise Act. Welcome to the show, Cedra.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. So ROP has been involved with helping to enforce Oregon's Sanctuary Promise Act and other immigrant justice work too. Let's get into that a little bit. Can you explain to our listeners what the Sanctuary Promise Act is?
Definitely. And I think before I do that, I'll give just a little bit of context about who ROP is for those who aren't familiar. Rural Organizing Project is a statewide organization that's supporting a multi-issue grassroots network around the state to advance human dignity and democracy. And so immigrant justice and sanctuary work really falls under that umbrella of all of our groups that are working to advance human dignity and make safe and welcoming communities. And when we talk about sanctuary law, Oregon is a sanctuary state, which means that it prohibits local and state law enforcement from collaborating with federal immigration authorities unless they have a court order, which means that Oregonians have the right to live and work and go to school without fear of being reported to ICE. And Oregon has some of the strongest sanctuary laws in the country, and a lot of that is thanks to rural community organizing. So we strengthened our sanctuary laws, specifically getting into this question about what the Sanctuary Promise Act is. That was a piece of legislation that was passed a few years ago in 2021 to expand and strengthen, close some loopholes in existing decades-old sanctuary laws and really ensure that no government or law enforcement agency can help federal immigration authorities or ICE without a warrant from a judge.
Can you talk to me a little bit about sort of the context of why something like that is so important?
Definitely. And this goes back to having this network of rural community-based groups around the state who are really tapped into their communities and their needs. We were starting to get calls from community members around the state after the passage of the Sanctuary Promise Act, saying that they were hearing of instances of ICE showing up, say, after someone was at the local police station or sheriff's department, and indications of that collaboration happening with local law enforcement communicating with federal immigration authorities, and it really putting members of the community at higher risk of detention and deportation and making them feel unsafe, to calling local law enforcement if there was a crime or something going on in their community. They weren't sure whether they could trust local law enforcement. And so it's all the more important to make sure that public bodies and local law enforcement aren't collaborating with federal immigration authorities so that folks feel safe in their homes and in their communities.
What does that collaboration look like in states that don't have this kind of sanctuary law protection?
Well, so in general, it's important to recognize that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is this multi-billion dollar federal agency. And so it looks like this huge federally funded agency coming into a town or a community and calling the local law enforcement body, which is invariably going to be much less funded and resourced, and saying, we need you to drop what you're doing and help us locate an individual, share information with us about anyone that you have booked, for example, and let us know what their country of origin status is. So it looks like local law enforcement bodies having to prioritize using their limited resources and budget to share information with federal immigration authorities, support them, assist them in detaining and arresting people.
So going back to the Sanctuary Promise Act, how well enforced and how well understood is this law in Oregon?
That's a great question. The short of it is that it's not very well understood or enforced. What we have started to learn in conversations with our rural human dignity leaders around the state is that not only does the general public often not know that we strengthened our sanctuary laws, the Sanctuary Promise Act, but police and other law enforcement individuals often don't know about those updated laws and haven't received training on them. So even if they believe they're in compliance with state sanctuary laws and want to be complying with those laws, they might not know the updated rules around the Sanctuary Promise Act and know how to be adjusting their policies and practices to comply with it. And so what we did is we partnered with lawyers, law students to go through and both request the county policies, the sheriff department policies that relate to sanctuary law in every county in the state, and then reviewed those policies to see whether they were in line with state sanctuary law. And what we learned is that about two-thirds of county local policies have not been updated since that 2021 passing of the Sanctuary Promise Act, so they are in violation of state law.
So looking at all of these different policies across the state as ROP compiled all these things, are there commonalities about what the language is that exists right now and where it needs to go?
That's a great question. And for specifics on the ways in which local policies are commonly in violation of state law, I would recommend folks go to our website where we have some tools around that, which is ROP.org. We have, in particular, we have a red flag tool that outlines some common kind of red flags in local policies that are out of line with the law. But the common thing that we'll see, or some of the common things that we'll see, is that local police departments or jails might still be asking, when they bring someone in and book them, they might still be asking them information about their status, their country of origin, without informing that person that they aren't required to give that information. And then these local law enforcement bodies might also be willingly, either proactively providing that information to ICE. We saw an instance of one local sheriff's department just sending an email to ICE, letting them know the status of anyone booked into their jail, or they might be providing that information if they receive a request from ICE without making sure that there's that additional step of having a judicial warrant to get that information.
So ROP has been working on the Sanctuary Promise Act and getting, you know, people better informed about this for a little while. What has the reaction been since doing the work to point out these policies that are out of step?
A lot of local human dignity groups have been taking this on in their communities. They're recognizing how important it is and how in line it is with their values to make sure that their community is following the Sanctuary Promise Act and being a safe and welcoming space for immigrants and all people. And so what a lot of folks have been doing is starting with the information that we have on our website at ROP.org, looking and seeing whether their county is in or out of compliance with state sanctuary laws. And then if it's not, making a plan to spread information both within the community and with local law enforcement. So the first example of this was back in 2023, a group of concerned community members in Cottage Grove in Lane County were made aware of some violations of the Sanctuary Promise Act and wanted to do something about it. They ended up, that started a conversation with local law enforcement. They weren't able to get through and make the changes they needed to, and we ended up filing a lawsuit against the city of Cottage Grove for violations of against the 2021 Sanctuary Promise Act, which was successful. It was the first lawsuit of its kind in the state, so really testing the teeth of the law, and we won, which meant that the city agreed to acknowledge that they were breaking the law and to work with us to start changing those policies and their staff training procedures to get in compliance with sanctuary law. And since then, a lot of other groups around the state have gone through similar processes of trying to figure out what's going on locally in their county, what policies are on the book, but also what practices are happening locally, and then having conversations in the community and with local law enforcement to make sure everyone knows what the rights are of immigrants in our community and make sure there aren't any kind of accidental violations of this law just because people don't even know about the updates.
What does it usually take to update these kind of policies? Is it something that involves local elected officials, or is it something that the sheriff can make happen?
It's something that a specific sheriff's department or police department can do on their own. Most of these departments, they have pages of policies on the books. They aren't necessarily writing all of them themselves. One thing that we've found is that many of these departments contract out with a big national company called Lexapol for their policies. And so sometimes they've paid this company to develop a policy and they've thrown it into their manual without realizing that it's in violation with Oregon-specific laws. So it's just a matter of going in, identifying the ways in which those policies are in violation with the law and updating them. But the other thing is, right, it's one thing to have a policy that's in line with the law, and it's another to make sure that all officers are trained on that policy and know what to do, say, if they get a call or request from ICE asking for assistance or for information, that they're trained on knowing that that's actually illegal under state law, that they need to not only not comply with that request, but in fact report it to the Oregon Department of Justice, which is another part of the sanctuary law, is that the Oregon Department of Justice is trying to track any instances of ICE asking for assistance from local law agencies. So that's, yeah, it's just a matter of doing it on that local level.
Well, Trump and his administration have made clear their intentions to weaponize immigration enforcement in ways that were not allowed during previous administrations. What has ROP's work around this issue looked like since the inauguration?
Yeah, it's, as you're mentioning, it's a really scary moment with a lot of threats and attacks on the immigrant community as well as others. And a lot of local groups are prioritizing responding and resisting to those threats that we're seeing. Some of that looks like a lot of this sanctuary work that we've been talking about, preemptively, proactively going and sitting down with local law enforcement and saying, are you committed to upholding our state sanctuary laws? But there's a lot of other things going on too across the state. So for example, when the Trump administration removed sensitive location protections from schools and churches and clinics, a lot of ROP human dignity groups started to work to pass pro-immigrant resolutions at the school, city, or county level to build up that community power, to protect immigrant community members, and say that these are not our values, this is not what we stand for. There's also a lot of folks that are part of the ROP network doing rapid response work right now. So we are seeing an uptick in ICE activity. We're also seeing a lot of rumors about ICE activity, which is, it's a really scary time. People are people are fearful and information spreads quickly. So that rapid response work that community members are doing looks like monitoring and verifying rumors. So, and then either being able to debunk rumors and ensure people when it isn't a true instance of ICE activity, or quickly respond in the case of a verified rumor, figure out exactly what's going on, be able to warn the community about ICE activity and keep people safe. Other actions that folks are taking kind of under this umbrella of responding to what's going on might look like accompaniment. So when folks have ICE appointments or court hearings, making sure that there's someone going with them to keep an eye on what's happening and document anything that happens. And then a huge chunk of this work right now is Know Your Rights. So spreading information about what rights immigrants have in our state as a sanctuary state, so that if they do have something happen, they know what resources they have access to, they know if the law is being broken. So individuals spreading that Know Your Rights information is a huge piece of this too.
What do you think are the most important things for folks to take away from our conversation, whether that's about immigrant justice work more generally or specifically about Oregon's Sanctuary Promise Act?
I would say to remember that even in this time with heightened attacks and threats coming from the federal level, that there are a lot of Oregon state level protections for immigrants in our community, and that those laws and protections are only as good as we as community members are informed and holding folks accountable to. So there's a huge amount that we can do as individuals, as groups in our communities, to make sure that both the Sanctuary Promise Act and other laws protecting folks in our communities are being followed.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way for folks to learn more would be to go to our website at ROP.org. You can navigate there to a lot more information about the Sanctuary Promise Act and how to take action locally. You can also find a button to sign up for our newsletter, where we send out a lot of updates and information, including about the Sanctuary Promise work and also other ways to get involved locally in your community by joining a human dignity group. And if you aren't sure where to start, there's also just our contact information, our email and our phone number, again, at our website at ROP.org. And you can find out who's taking action locally and how to find your people.
Well, Cedra, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Cedra Pearson from the Rural Organizing Project speaking with me about immigrant justice and Oregon's Sanctuary Promise Act. More information is online at ROP.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Laura Grimes, Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to discuss some of the latest news from the local art scene. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk us through and get us updated on what is going on. First story this week, this one's called Poetry from the People, Street Roots Vendors Create Rhyme and Reason. So this is about the Street Roots Poetry Group. What can you tell me about this story?
The story was written by Elizabeth Barron, who is a really first-rate journalist. She used to write for the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post and I always get really excited when Elizabeth has a story that we publish. And this particular story is about poets where they meet weekly at Street Roots headquarters at 3rd and Burnside in what they call School in the Sky. It is a college-like class where the facilitator is Katie Rossing, and she does run it like a college class. They study and write poetry. It's challenging. They grapple with heady ideas. And poetry has always been a part of Street Roots. They've usually published it in their newspapers that you can see where vendors sell them. Cost $2 now, outside grocery stores and the like. And they always have good information. And poetry has always been a part of that. So this particular story is about a photographer, Jim Lomason, who has a large body of work where he photographs the objects of refugees, and he prints them out, and then the people handwrite on the images what the objects mean to them. And Jim has had these images exhibited at the Oregon Historical Society, at Ellis Island in New York, at the headquarters of the United Nations in New York. So it's a substantial, important work. And he considers this body of work, in his own words, a bridge-building project to illustrate our common humanity. So he wanted to take the same approach to documenting people who live on the streets for the most part. And so he collaborated with Street Roots to work on this project in the past year. He photographed people who take part in these weekly poetry study sessions. And each person either posed themselves with an object or had their objects photographed. And then he printed them out. And then the people wrote on them. One person, poses with his dog, and there's a pair of socks, a little doll, a compass, a variety of images. And the people who write in their own words on these images about what these objects mean to me, they're quite moving, quite beautiful. And so all these photos are on exhibit now at the Central Library's Collins Gallery through March 15th. So it's just, what a terrific project. It'd be fun to just go to the library and see it. And it's meaningful for the library to be doing this project where street people often hang out and seek refuge during the day. So I think this project is very meaningful.
And it covers some of what this poetry workshop, this weekly poetry workshop, actually looks like, too. It goes quite in depth, so that's very cool as well.
It is, yeah, what the people are doing and really these very serious ideas that they grapple with in this beautiful poetry. Katie, who facilitates it, talks about how she finds it quite humbling, like, something that might take her 4 to 5 drafts to do, somebody just will rattle off in 10 minutes, and it just goes, wow. It's a really terrific way for people to be able to express themselves and bring together a community. So I think it's just a really important story.
We have a couple others to talk about, keeping up with the arts organizations in town, including the Portland Opera, which is moving to downtown. Talk to me about this one.
The Portland Opera has been located down on OMSI for some years now, near there, down by the river. And they recently sold that space to the Native American Rehabilitation Association of the Northwest, which had been looking for a space near the river. So it kind of seems like a good move for everyone. The association, the Native American Rehabilitation Association, can use it for a gathering space for the Native American community. And then the Portland Opera is moving downtown to the World Trade Center, which is between 1st and 2nd Avenues on Salmon Street. And it will be a better size for them. They will have a 200-seat theater, which is, I've never been there. It's a really lovely space. It's really comfortable. And they'll have an outdoor plaza area. So it puts them closer to where they usually perform, which is at Keller Auditorium and the Newmark Theater. And it's sort of a part of a growing trend for arts companies to move to downtown. It follows All Classical Radio moving to the Coin Tower and Northwest Children's Theater moving to the Broadway building. So they hope to be a part of revitalizing downtown. And so I'm excited for them. I think it's a better size for them and a really beautiful space. And it's good for them to move someplace where they can have a performing area as well.
There's also some news about the Lansu Chinese Garden as well. There's an expansion they're planning?
Yeah, they're planning on it. The Lansu Chinese Garden has been a landmark of Old Town for 25 years. You know, that beautiful, beautiful garden space that they have. And they've been looking to expand to a neighboring block and making this two-block area a whole cultural center for, you know, we'll have classrooms and meeting rooms and an art gallery. They want to have a demonstration kitchen and banquet facilities, performance spaces, outdoor spaces, on and on. And so it's a really ambitious plan. They don't own that second block yet, but they're planning on launching a capital campaign, and they hope to complete the project by 2030. So we'll see how that develops and see if Old Town gets, you know, a bigger sort of vital Chinese cultural center.
Oregon Arts Watch is also featuring a photo essay from someone who was at jury duty, which is, you know, I didn't know I needed to see a photo essay of that. What can you tell me about that one?
Yeah, so this is my story. I ended up on jury duty in January, which was quite exhausting, actually. I was surprised how tiring it was. And because it's just, you know, you sort of unexpectedly have to put your life on hold. And not just, you know, just not, it's not just like you're doing something else, but you really have to intimately live inside somebody else's space. You have to take notes and pay attention to details, and just all of that brain intake is very tiring. It's very taxing. So quite by accident, I started taking photos out of the courthouse windows, and the jury room is in a restricted area that you can only access through a security door. So it's a view that not many people get a chance to see. And that new courtroom downtown is quite beautiful. It's down near the downtown, near the Hawthorne Bridge. I was really taken with how beautiful it was. I have to say the whole, as tiring as the experience was, it was really hopeful. I really appreciated how respectful the whole culture was in the courtroom. Very respectful. I happen to be blessed with being paired with a group of really wonderful jurors, so I appreciated that. But one thing I would say is that as I started to take photos, something I don't mention in the story that I wish I had is that there was just this strength and power in these photos. You know, I'm not a knowledgeable photographer. I don't know how to use a regular camera. I just know how to frame a shot and push a button. So all I had was my phone, and I couldn't capture, because it wasn't a sophisticated camera, I couldn't capture details. I couldn't capture people and organic shapes. So I had to lean into what I could capture, which were these buildings. And I was really struck by how there were just the steel and cement. They were really muscular, you know, several stories of just strong images. So I took, you know, strong angles, and there was a strength in the repetition. But all of that was a really sharp contrast to these precarious lives that were unfolding in the courtroom, where people were physically fragile. They seemed to live on the margins of society. They were seemed to be financially insecure. It was humbling. It was interesting. I know it's interesting to talk about photos on the radio, but I was just really struck with how these photos unfolded and that they became sort of my lifeline, you know, from this tiny little jury room. I was able to capture these expansive images, and that were in, you know, such a sharp contrast from the lives that we had, that we were tasked with passing judgment on. It was trying, but it was also, I would say, worthwhile, and I felt honored to be able to participate in the jury system, which, and I have to say too, a point of the story is that it seemed fitting to be taking photos of this building, because you think of the court system as being a foundation of our civil society, so it's fitting to explore the building blocks of the city.
If our listeners are interested in seeing this photo story or any of the other stories that we talked about, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can read all about these at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Laura, thank you so much for coming on to talk with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest news from the local art scene. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
We'd like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed, double-breasted, form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and of course, a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer
Joe... This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. Meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance